your host, Jeff Ragavan, and welcome to the Alchemy Podcast, where we're on a quest to explore the intersection of cannabis, compliance, and creative in the marketing world today and beyond. Welcome back to another episode of Alchemy. Today, I'm joined with Chad Bronstein, founder and CEO of Philo, and Nitin Khanna, Portland-based serial entrepreneur. Nitin, it's great to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So, Nitin, you've had quite the last decade. In 2015, you launched your first cannabis company, Cura, and acquired another, Select, during the following year. And Cura went on to become one of the largest cannabis companies in the world by revenue standards. And then you sold Cura to Curaleaf for $950 million. And now fast forward to here we are today, your present venture at Sensia Wellness. So first off, congrats on all of your success.
Thank you so much. It's been a wild ride. Numbers don't do justice to what an incredible journey it's been in terms of, you know, working with people and forging in this kind of semi-illegal industry, but enjoyed every minute of it, even the difficult times.
Absolutely. So, Nitin, you know, obviously you've had an extremely interesting and very, you know, story and journey in your career. So it'd be great if you could take us back a little bit to the beginning, you know, when you first moved to the U.S. at a young age of 17.
Yeah, you know, my entrepreneurial journey actually starts at a pretty young age. My first memory of what we call entrepreneurship today, what our parents probably call just business, was at the age of 4 and 5. I was constantly hanging around my uncles, my mother's brothers, who own a wide variety of businesses, and my grandfather did too. And so, you know, when I think of how much I learned just by osmosis, just by being around them, that has helped me be successful in business today. You know, I just didn't want to lose that part of it, that I think so much of what has made me understand everything from, you know, the value of cash in a business to collections to how to treat people and build a team came from hanging around a lot of other folks who were building businesses as I was very young. And so when I was 17, my family looked around and what we found was I was the eldest grandchild on both sides of my family. And every other grandchild had was not academically doing as well as I was, but was already involved in the business. And because I was doing academically well, everybody thought it'd be a good idea for me to come to the States, get an undergrad in engineering, get a graduate degree in business administration, get an MBA, and then come back to India and potentially coalesce all these wide businesses that my uncles and my cousins owned. And so that was really the reason why I came to the U.S. But the really interesting story there is when I got off the plane in LAX, my father had sent me via Tokyo, and I only had $40 because that's all my dad could get together in terms of foreign currency. And I'd spent that in Tokyo in an overnight in Tokyo. And when I was boarding the plane in Japan, I didn't have the $24 transfer fee. And the Northwest Airlines, and this is how far we go back, when Northwest Airlines was still a thing, the agent at the desk loaned me the $10, and I landed at LAX, and I had no money in my pocket, and I had to convince the bus driver to take me for free to USC, and left my suitcases under a tree, and had the international student lady lend me $400 till my aunt could wire it to her, you know, Western Union it to her the next day. So when I think of my U.S. journey and being 17, it truly started at zero with three good Samaritans, you know, the bus driver, the lady at the International Student Office and the lady at Northwest Airlines doing small good deeds for me. And you know, I'll never forget that. And I think it's formed the basis massively of how I think and treat other people.
You got to find those people.
It'd be really incredible to go back and tell them, you know, how it evolved from there.
So nice.
Yeah, and that's an awesome story. And it's obviously led to you being a visionary. So, you know, cannabis, we haven't been as long as you have, but you're one of the first entrepreneurs in the cannabis space to spot a huge potential, obviously with a lot of massive risk. Talk to us about your move into cannabis space and the opportunity you first saw in it.
So thank you for your comments, Chad. I mean, in 2014, I started seeing the same writing on the wall. Probably a lot of people did. I was 42 years old. You know, I'd had a pretty nice exit with Sabre 7 years prior to that when I was 35. And I was looking to go back into a high growth business. And I thought to myself, you know, 55-year-old Nitin is going to really be upset if I look back and I didn't take advantage of this opportunity. And I had two or three things going for me that maybe not a lot of people do when I made that decision. The first and biggest was that I was able to make my own decision about entering cannabis. If 2014 isn't that long ago, but the stigma was much higher. And so many of the professionals I spoke to were very worried that if they entered the cannabis business too early, and it didn't work out, they could not go back to their regular professions and other industries. And because of my prior exit, I was very blessed that I was actually able to make the decision as a professional to enter an industry which at that point was dominated by people we actually have to thank. You know, all those folks who were in the cannabis industry when it wasn't legalized and helped legalize it, we owe a huge debt of gratitude to them. But professional management was having a difficult time entering the market. And so I made a couple of investments in 2014, and that didn't really scratch my itch. It turned out that I realized that I really wanted to be an entrepreneur in the cannabis business, be in, you know, in the initial days of the industry and really forge the pathway for others. Now, there were days I absolutely regretted being so early in the industry, such as, you know, when our bank accounts kept getting shut down every 2 weeks and we couldn't make back-to-back payroll. And there were some very difficult times early on. But, you know, as I've said when I've talked to you guys before, I've really enjoyed every minute of it. But in 2015, I saw this opportunity that it was a company I actually invested in February of 2015 called Terwilliger Partners. And I got a call in June that said, you know, the company had run out of money, didn't really have a very strategic plan. And would I be interested in stepping in and taking over as CEO? And so I did that. So on July 1st of 2015, I became CEO of that company. I changed its name to Cura. And at that point, it owned a couple of machines that extracted cannabis oil from the cannabis plant. It owned a couple retail stores, and it owned a small grow. And I decided to focus on the consumer end of the business. So I sold off the retail stores, I sold off the grow, and really started focusing on developing consumer products, which in our case became the vaporizer cartridge. And so by November, I was firmly focused on it, which is when I met Cameron Forney, who was running the company Select and who really became my partner. And we consider ourselves co-founders of the company. But that's kind of how we got started. And my mindset was simple. My businesses that I've run are in highly competitive spaces in which execution is what is important. So none of the businesses, none of the entrepreneurial ventures I've had are what I'd call high idea companies. They were high execution companies. And cannabis is the ultimate execution industry, right? It is a $250 billion plus already existing market. And whoever comes into it and executes better, you don't have to have the idea. People already want cannabis. You have to, you know how to lobby. You have to know how to do government relations. You know how to really protect yourself given the federal environment. So it actually could benefit the most from professional management, which is what was lacking. And so I thought, if I threw my hat in the ring and I was able to recruit other professional executives who would come into the space, you know, because others like me were coming into the space, not from the cannabis industry, but from other professional industries, we could out-execute. And that's what happened. You know, it actually shocked the world that in 16, 17, and 18, that the highest revenue cannabis company in the world was based in Oregon, which everybody thinks is a horrendous place for cannabis because it's an unlimited license state and cannabis has been around here for a very long time. And it was almost everything to do with that strategy. And I think that's another way of saying people and your leadership teams and the people they hire are the critical difference between, you know, massive success and potentially no success at all.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. That's literally how we live and breathe here. But that's awesome to hear. And I'm going to take home with me the high idea. I like what you just said about high idea. You're not high idea, you're high execution, which I really, that's really cool to hear.
I admire what you guys are doing because in what you're doing, you're forging new paths, but in a very unique way. It's something you saw an opportunity and and clearly existed, but nobody really knew how to take advantage of it. And as you know, we really enjoy working with your company and your product as well. For that reason, I think there's a high degree of alignment in the culture.
That's awesome. So I wanted to just take a quick step back as you were really talking about, you know, Cura, and you know, it's no surprise, and there's tons and tons of great articles about you and the company as well, going back from, you know, 2015 all the way into 2018, of really having like the largest revenue numbers out there. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about, you know, what it actually was, like what was the strategy that was giving you guys that ability to hit such high record revenues and growth so early?
I think it was a combination of strategy and people and execution. The strategy was early on in that we focused on vaporizer cartridges. Early in the industry, you know, in 2015, these cartridges had an extremely high rate of failure. 10, 20, 30% of the cartridges would fail. And yet I noticed when, you know, I got into the business that people were buying it. It was the number one SKU in almost every state where you could get data. And so we decided to focus on this. And that's where I have to give a lot of credit to my partner, Cameron. He, I think, is one of the world's foremost authorities on really understanding and knowing what goes into a vaporizer cartridge. And so when I met him, his passion around the Select brand he had built, but most importantly, his knowledge of the cartridge he was selling. And he would visit China and he knew everything about the plant and he knew everything about the technical specs of the cartridge. And he had gotten the failure rate down to 8%. And just while we were talking between November 15 and April 2016, when we acquired Select, you know, he'd gotten the failure rate down to 2%. And we really felt that that, in an industry in which innovation is otherwise hard to come by, you know, all the innovation seemed to be how many pounds of cannabis can you get off of a square foot or a light? And everybody was focused on, you know, maximizing, if you will, either the quality or quantity of the cannabis. And here we were talking about a consumer packaged good. And so the strategy was to really have CPG style packaging, use branding, and be extraordinarily focused on only one part of the business. As I said, we were vertically integrated. And when we disassembled that and started focusing on a single piece of the business that was, you know, the largest SKU that was selling. And so that was the strategy part. The team part, as I mentioned, Cameron was both very, very knowledgeable about the cartridge, but he was also an extraordinary salesperson and really understood the cannabis mindset and what consumers wanted and what retailers wanted. And he put together a sales team that was very key. And then I'd say lastly, it was because we had professional management and were able to explain our strategy professionally, we were able to raise capital relatively easily and relatively large amounts of capital. So that allowed us to expand from Oregon in 16 to California in early 17, and then to Nevada and Arizona in late 17. And you know, that is what drove the revenues from, I think it was 8 million in 16 and 40 million in 2017 and 118 million in 2018. It's that strategy, capital, people, and execution combination. Probably not unlike what you would expect, but I think we did it really well at Cura.
I remember when I first went down to Canada to raise money, your name was thrown out as the, you know, the example. So, and that's kind of how we met, right? So I heard a lot of amazing things about you. So you did it well, and I'm definitely getting some good takeaways from this conversation. Definitely from a question I have is, you're a deal guy, right? You've obviously had a couple of great exits. Yeah. A lot of people don't know how deals actually happen. And, you know, Jeff's had a great couple exits too, and deals happen sporadically. Can you talk to us about how you actually, the Curaleaf deal happened, and just when it happened? And I think it's good for the listeners and entrepreneurs to hear, because obviously everyone wants a great exit like you've had multiple times. So you obviously have a good recipe for it.
You know, M&A requires a lot of intentionality. Every business I've ever started has been with the goal of an M&A exit in mind. And what that means is you hold yourself to a very high standard right from the get-go, right? And from the people you hire to how you conduct yourself to making hard decisions that may not lead to immediate revenue but add enterprise value. As an example, Chad, you know how compliant Sensha is when it comes to FDA regulations, and you guys help us do that. And a lot of e-commerce websites who are selling CBD don't care about FDA compliance issues because they're focused on immediate revenue. However, we are focused on the long-term enterprise value of the company as an indicator upfront to our team and to everybody who works with us that what we're focused on is enterprise value and potential M&A in the future. Now, that doesn't mean you're constantly hunting for a deal. It means you hold yourself to these very high standards in terms of your financial accounting and your records and your audits and your people and your ethical practices and your HR practices. So across the board, I feel whether you sell your company or not, if you have an M&A mindset in your company, you are going to do better than if you didn't. And I hope that makes sense why you would do that. You're just always operating at that higher level that somebody might come in at any minute and start looking at your record. So being a deal guy means having intentionality towards M&A. Of course, there are lots and lots of lifestyle businesses that, you know, generate great value and then somebody comes along and buys them. But for me, it's always been talking about M&A to our team, thinking about it in the future so that when the time is right and when the opportunity comes along, you're able to take advantage of it. Specifically with Cura, how the Curaleaf deal came together is in the fall of 2018, all of the current MSOs, the multi-state operators, the large U.S. cannabis companies, were going public on the Canadian Stock Exchange. You know, Curaleaf went public, Harvest went public, GTI went public, and Acreage. Those four big companies went public. We were fifth in line to go public. And we were supposed to start trading March of 2019. And what happened was I took a look at the broader landscape, cannabis landscape, and I realized that there was potentially going to be a dramatic fall in the prices of publicly traded stocks. They were so overvalued, especially the Canadian stocks. But the world only really knew about the Canadian stocks. You know, just the way Canopy trades is the way the whole cannabis index trades. And it's starting to separate a little bit. But even till today, you know, how Canopy and Tilray and Cronos do dictates more of how the U.S. companies trade. And so I didn't want to go public in an environment in which, you know, we're running a company in which the stock price is falling 60, 70, 80%. Now, I turned out to be proven right, but what, and that was, you know, whether it was a lucky guess or just I knew the industry really well, we turned our attention away from going public and towards M&A. And Boris Jordan, who is on our board, and it was also at that point, I think the chairman or the CEO of Curaleaf, you know, and so I spoke to our board and I said, I don't think we should go public. I think we should run a process and do M&A. And the board authorized me to go speak to a few folks, which I did. And we went and spoke to everybody significant in the industry. And as it turns out, somebody sitting on our own board placed the highest value on the company. Of course, he knew the company from the inside and he'd seen us grow it. And so while it wasn't run by a banker, you know, I talked to most of the buyers myself. We ended up doing a deal, which what you would call somebody who really knew the company well. And so it came together kind of relatively quickly. The deal when it was done was really done at a Curaleaf stock price level. So it was actually an $860 million deal. The day it was announced, Curaleaf stock price had gone up. So it was announced as a $953 million deal. And I don't want to only talk about the good things. We have lots of challenges and people should understand how to kind of navigate M&A through challenges as well. And the biggest challenge thrown at us last year was that our deal was over $90 million. $90 million is the threshold at which point the U.S. Department of Justice or the FTC can review deals. And at that point, the U.S. federal government was reviewing every deal over $90 million. That HSR process, also called Hart-Scott-Rodino, is an extraordinarily difficult process. One of the most difficult things because you've already sold the company. You have limited capital. You have to operate it in good faith relative to the covenants that you've sold it under. And you've got an unlimited time that the federal government can take to approve your deal. So it's hard to motivate people. And it's because, you know, they know that within a few months, you're no longer going to be there, that somebody else is going to be running the company. And you can't raise capital because you've already sold the company. And so you have to tamp down growth a little bit. And so that was an extraordinarily difficult process. Almost every company, there were 7 or 8 deals in HSR and cannabis. I believe other than us, only one other deal got done. Every other deal in cannabis, large M&A, failed because of the buyer's stock having gone down tremendously during HSR. May 1 was the last year was the point when cannabis stocks were at their peak, and they're all down between 40 and 90% since last May. And so the sellers were not wanting to complete the deal because the buyer's stock was down and they were wanting to renegotiate it. The buyer's mindset was, well, had you gone public yourself or if you were public, your value would now be diminished. You know, and so if you're taking a relative valuation, you should actually make less. In this very difficult environment came the vaping crisis. As you know, last summer, illegal vape cartridges started killing people, but nobody knew at the beginning what was causing those deaths. You know, Juul suffered tremendously because of it. And us, as the largest cannabis vaping company in the world, had the most dramatic impact. It hit our revenues, I'd say, just in 1 month. In back-to-back months, revenues dropped 30% 1 month and 40% on top of it the following month in September and October of last year. So what the government didn't realize is by putting us through a 7, 8, 9 month HSR process, you know, they opened up to these things that can happen to you. And one of the things that happened to our company was a vaping crisis. And so we had to renegotiate the deal. And the end of the, you know, the deal was done at 95 million shares. We ended at 55 million shares with an ability to earn back those 40 million shares during our earnout in 2020. So that's a long way of saying that M&A can be very, very, very intricate, and you have to be really on top of your game. And even when you have a home run outcome, like an announced deal at 950 million, you could end up with a deal that, you know, on the day it closed was closer to 400 million. And I just want to be honest about the ups and the downs of the process.
Well, I've got a story for you when we get off this podcast or another time. I feel your pain. I've been through something very similar.
I mean, it literally $500 million off from the day we signed, which, you know, if you're trying to assign value to the negotiation, you couldn't fault our negotiation. We got 950 million value on the day we signed the contract. And then you look at what happens when time passes, and this is why they say time kills ordeals, or definitely hurts them. And all the other buyers and sellers are now in litigation against each other.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, I feel like that as entrepreneurs, that's our biggest fear. You know, you work so hard, you know, to get to that, you know, goal line. And then there are things that are outside of your control that may delay things. And when you delay things, it opens up the spectrum of a lot of things that could go wrong beyond your control. So it's a good learning lesson there too for a lot of people, you know, as they're, you know, working through some big deals. So thanks a lot for sharing that with everybody. You know, Nitin, it also sounds like, you know, you're also, you know, building another empire. So congrats again, you know, with Sentia Wellness, and you guys are quickly becoming a pretty massive company. And I'm curious, you know, to hear from you, like what exactly was it that made you kind of move into the CBD world? What was the vision behind Sentia?
So the vision behind Sentia actually started in the Cura days. If you recall, the deal with Cura is in some ways even better than the top line number sounded. What we did was we split the company. And so what we sold to Curaleaf was only the THC business. And we kept the CBD business. So I raised, in addition to doing that deal, at the very same day, so we announced the Cura sale on May 1. And what we also did, which is not very public, is we raised $90 million on a convertible note with a cap of $1.45 billion to launch Sentia as a CBD business. So it was a pretty dramatic day given how much value we were getting for our CBD business. And my desire to run the CBD business was, I'd been in the cannabis space for 4 years. As I've alluded to before, you know, it's a very difficult regulatory world to live in. And I was looking forward to taking my learnings from that space and everything I learned about the cannabis consumer or the benefits of the cannabis plant and moving it more into the CPG mass market retail space. And so even when I approached our board to talk about selling the business, it was always my intent that if it were at all possible, we would keep the CBD business. And so founded Sentia as a new company, and then Sentia acquired the CBD assets off Cura, including for a period of time, for 3 months, acquiring the select CBD brand until we could launch our own brand in August, which is now called Social CBD. So Sentia's mission in life is to provide natural solutions for modern life. And the insight there, Jeff, and the pandemic really brings this insight home, is that the problem most of us face today is simply modern life. right? Both pair, and you can look at it at almost any socioeconomic status, from middle class to upper middle class families where, you know, both parents are working, working out, kids have multiple activities, they may have multiple homes. All of this sounds really nice, but it creates that kind of anxiety and sleeplessness. And social media creates the FOMO that somebody else is living a better life. And we've got this gnawing anxiety as a generation, even though in a lot of economic ways, we're all better off than we ever have been in history. You go down the socioeconomic spectrum and you've got, you know, single moms working 2-3 jobs to feed their family in very difficult circumstances. Income inequality is spreading. They're coming home very tired from their multiple jobs. And so when you look at a product that can solve these 3 or 4 big problems of modern life, you know, kind of this daily anxiety, you don't know what to attribute it to, muscle aches, pains, sleeplessness as a problem to be solved, and the counterpart of sleep, which is energy. And so the insight at Sentia is there have to be natural solutions beyond, you know, new records being set by alcohol and new records being set by cannabis. And all of those things in appropriate quantities make sense. But what could we offer people that would help them with sleep, energy, anxiety, and muscle aches and pains? And CBD is almost the perfect ingredient for that. So, I mean, the story almost kind of wrote itself. So Sentia's ultimate goal in life is to provide multiple product lines that help people with these problems of modern life, but they are all natural-based, plant-based solutions, as opposed to, you know, if you look at it at the worst end, the opioid crisis is an example of what we are trying to avoid with some of our solutions.
Yeah. Nin, so actually, I've had the pleasure of seeing Sentia grow over the past 7 months. And I would say, you know, coronavirus is obviously a horrible situation for most. But what we have seen being that we work with a lot of the brands is that growth in CBD for the good brands have skyrocketed. Have you seen that with Sentia over the past, during the coronavirus timeframe? Like you just mentioned earlier, anxiety is full blown now. And so we've seen more people turn to CBD during this time. Have you seen the same?
So we have seen the same, Chad. Let me just break it down. There are three main places where people get CBD. One is at cannabis stores. Just by our formation, you can't buy our products at cannabis stores. Growth there has been massive during the pandemic because people are going to the stores anyways to pick up cannabis. And as you may have heard, March was the best month in cannabis history for retailers. April's been very good. As just in form of our charter, we decided early on because we were thinking of IPOing in the US to not have any of our assets commingled with any cash or any receipts from cannabis. So that is a channel that is in high growth that is closed off to us. The next place, of course, where you can buy CBD is in mass market retail, where we believe we're the largest distributor. We're at CVS, we're at Walgreens, we're at 7-Eleven, we're at Publix, we're in Speedway, you know, gas stations, we're at Murphy's, convenience stores. So you can find us in a broad range of places. But in those places, national retailers, you can only buy topicals. And as you know, topicals are only about 10% of the market. So where can the consumer who loves your brand go to buy your product? It's online. And we have seen tremendous growth in online, especially during the coronavirus. I would say between February and March, we grew, and you may know these numbers better than me, we grew about 30%. And then March to April, we grew about 20%. And May looks to be by far the strongest growth. We may grow as much as 30, 35% again this month. Online. And that's the most direct in the mass market retail. One, you can only get topicals, but two, I think the consumers really focus on the essentials, you know, toilet paper and food and those kind of grocery items. And so we've taken our focus online over the past few months, and it's produced incredible results. So yes, I do believe people are absolutely seeking a solution like CBD, which, you know, in some ways is a real validation of our original mission.
That's awesome. So Nitin, I wanted to, you know, quickly talk to you as far as, you know, consumer trust and loyalty. I know that we see a tremendous amount of consumers out there who might have tested CBD at one point in time, or they haven't, and they want to get started. And there's so many places that they can get it now. How are you guys really thinking about, you know, developing that loyalty with the consumer so they keep coming back for your products?
You know, that's a great question. It's in cannabis, you know, Select was the largest brand. And then we did a brand study and we found that on across the board, less than 1% of people recognize any cannabis brand. You know, those of us who are in the industry know that MedMen's a great brand and Select was a huge brand. But actual consumer recognition, if you're thinking of yourself as a CPG company, is very low and it's still very nascent. So we're trying to stay very humble about that fact that we think while a lot of people, you know, use social CBD, it is not yet on the radars of it, of what people would consider, you know, a brand that can be recognized. So we work very hard every day to make people, and it starts with products, right? So and inside the products, it starts with testing. Every product we sell is tested 5 times through its supply chain before it gets to the consumer. And this comes because of our cannabis days, because in cannabis, testing was regulated and mandated. Since we started a CBD company, we kept that same extremely high testing mindset in our minds to make sure we're providing, you know, products that are pure, that are effective, that are powerful, that taste great, that look great, the packaging look great. So we're coming at all of it with the same kind of mindset that you would have. But I think more importantly is to create a relationship with the consumer by really expressing to them this broader mission we have, which is trying to help them find natural solutions for modern life. So one of the next steps for us is to couch our products inside solutions, right? So for example, if you're having anxiety, we are trying to see if we can partner with one of the meditation apps like Calm or somebody that describes that, you know, CBD is not a panacea. We can't tell people like, take this pill and you can go to sleep even though you've been watching Netflix on your phone the last couple hours in bed. And you've got, you know, your phone right next to you. And as soon as you wake up, you're going to pick up the phone. I think you have to say, here are the best practices. Take a warm bath, buy an alarm clock, put your phone away in a different room, use this Calm app and take your CBD and you're probably going to have a much better night of sleep. And so how do we turn our products into solutions? As an example, and this idea comes from our chief marketing officer who came from Nike and ran Fuel Band at Nike, right? Nike sells a running shoe, but the way they take it and turn it into a solution and really get the consumer to have an affinity to their brand is through things like the Fuel Band and other apps that help you really think of the shoe, the product as secondary and the brand as primary. And I think we're in that kind of a phase where we're turning the brand, having spent the last year in creating what we feel are the best products in the industry and the safest, to now seeing how can we turn them into solutions for our consumers. And one of the big examples is our free CBD promotion. I don't know if you've seen it, but you know, we took out the most expensive billboard in LA, corner of Sunset and Doheny, and we put an ad up there that just said, go to socialcbd.com/stayhome and we'll give you free CBD. And our point was, you do your part, we'll do our part. We know it's difficult to stay home, but if you stay home, we're going to give you free CBD. And it's been an enormous success. 40,000 people have visited our site in the last 10 days. And we are shipping them boost capsules for the morning. We're shipping them some gummies to stay balanced during the day. And we're shipping them sleep capsules and really helping people understand that when we're asking them to stay home, that we are going to step up and help them as well. And I think that's kind of how you build consumer loyalty.
Me and Jeff need one of those care packages.
You do.
And by the way, all your listeners can get it. You literally just go to socialcbd.com/stayhome. I think it's a $1 or $2 shipping charge. Just because we don't want robots to, you know, go out and take all the free offers, we have to charge a little bit for shipping. But I think you get about $20 worth of product at retail for just going on there. And then please, everybody can take advantage of it. And our goal is really to get people to try it and see if it's an effective product for them to try during these times.
Yeah, that campaign was great. And I think it's great what you guys are doing there. So then obviously we appreciate you giving all these insights. You know, not many people get to hear from people like you, and get insights like from you. So that's great. And we appreciate it. What advice, you know, cause you're an entrepreneur, not in just cannabis, but like you said, in technology and a multitude of other facets, what advice do you give if someone's listening here to inspiring entrepreneurs?
You know, Chad, first of all, thank you guys for your kind words. You've been really generous with the compliments and I really appreciate them. You know, it's not daily that I do stuff like this. So, thank you for that. My advice for entrepreneurs is, first of all, I think there is a lot of appreciation for entrepreneurship as a profession these days. And in some ways, you can get pushed into the profession, even if it may not be ideal for you. So my first advice is to really, truly understand what are the opportunities and the challenges, what are the joys, and really the some of the really crazy psychological swings that come with being an entrepreneur. I've advised far too many people for whom entrepreneurship was the wrong profession. You know, they left a good paying job, got into entrepreneurship, and it just wasn't right for them. And so with so many accelerators, so many incubators, so many mentors, so much, you know, angel funds and VCs coming at us, it's easy to sometimes believe entrepreneurship is for everybody. It's not. Not everybody can be a doctor. Not everybody can be a basketball star. You know, not everybody, you know, can be an artist. And in the same way, not everybody can be an entrepreneur. Because of my role for 6 years, I was primarily, between selling the software company and starting the cannabis company, I was primarily a mentor. You know, this advice comes really from the heart to say, make sure before you make such a big leap that you're ready for it. And by being ready for it, you know, the other piece of advice I would give people is some of the stuff we've talked about on this call. You know, having a fundamental understanding of the various things that make up a company and that its core, it's finance and accounting, it's sales, it's product development, it's marketing, and know what you're good at. And you have to know how to surround yourself with great people. You know, you and Jeff, Chad, were talking at the beginning of this conversation about how valuable it was that you met on a founder panel and that you're constantly seeking the best people. And so I think knowing what you're good at, knowing that entrepreneurship is right for you, and knowing how to surround yourself with people better than you at the skills you're not great at, are some of the key advice I can give entrepreneurs. The other piece of advice I'll give, having been a mentor, is learn how to take advice. I've seen far too many people ask questions and then almost not listen to the answer. The flip side of that is make sure you give enough detail for the advice to be valuable, right? I mean, people give advice from their own perspective, and I think it can be a really dangerous thing because not at all advice applies equally in all situations. So if you are taking advice from somebody, make sure that they really know your situation and position and problem in detail. And then when they give an answer, you're listening really carefully.
Yeah, and I agree. I don't know if you watch, been watching this funny note, but The Last Dance, the Michael Jordan series.
I've been meaning
the way Michael Jordan is as a competitor and pushes the people around him. I think as leaders, when you talk about professional management, high execution, it's about creating a team and all the leader being able, willing to do whatever it takes and teach that way. And I think that's kind of what, you know, listening to you is what I've taken away, is that you're a leader and you're willing to do anything that you tell someone else to do. And I think that's one thing that you take away from This Last Dance, is he would do anything that he asked someone else to do, and he'd push him to the limit for that as well.
Absolutely. You know, I'm fortunate that my daughter, who just turned 18, she's working for us at Sensha now, and she does everything from going out to the manufacturing plant to package, including these free CBD offers. She's been doing that with three friends the last few days. But she's a content writer for the website. She also works in the marketing department to send out, you know, kits to influencers. And I think it's an indication of that not just myself, but, you know, even a family member should do all parts of the job and learn the business from the ground up. And really, your job as the CEO, as a founder, is player coach. And what you have to figure out is, which part of the business are you so good at that you can be a coach? And which part of the business are you going to be a player and take coaching?
That's awesome. Well, Nitin, we appreciate, you know, all this great insight. And I think this show in particular is going to resonate with so many people out there. So thank you. And, you know, we always do these shows, and the format is business in the beginning, and then, you know, we have a little fun at the end. So we have a couple of quick fire questions for you. Are you ready?
Yeah.
How would you describe New York City to a blind person?
I mean, the way I would describe New York City to a blind person is, it's probably the one city you don't want to be in, because you're going to run into a lot of walls and a lot of cars, pandemic notwithstanding, and a lot of people. So if you are trying to run into a lot of things, it's probably a city you should be in. If you're trying not to run into anything, it's probably not the right city to be in. Is the first thing that comes to mind.
It's a good answer. I thought we would have to phone a friend for a second.
Yeah, Sour Patch Kids or Swedish Fish?
Oh my God, Sour Patch Kids for sure. Even though I love Swedish Fish, and my wife's favorite ad campaign of all time, and I think she brings it up every day, is first they're sour, then they're sweet. I don't know if you guys have seen them, but there's hundreds of them on YouTube. And if those of you listening, you have to go watch these first you're sour, then you're sweet. They're like 5 second or 10 second ads. Have you guys seen them?
Yeah, I have. Then I have a huge bag of Sour Patch Kids in my house at all times. So I agree with you on that.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how good are you at trivia?
I am not good at pop trivia, but I generally think my general knowledge of world affairs is pretty good. But, you know, current movie stars, current singers, that kind of stuff, I would say not very well.
My category is always science. Everything else I suck at.
Well,
I think we all have our trivia categories that we're good at, right?
Yep.
What size bed do you prefer?
I prefer a king size bed all to myself. Cold.
Who's your favorite Harry Potter character?
Oh my God, it's been so long since I've read a Harry Potter book and I didn't see any of the movies, but I have a vision of this kid in glasses flying around on a broomstick. So I guess I'll pick Harry Potter himself.
How would you rate your karaoke skills on a scale of 1 to Mariah Carey?
Mariah Carey in the shower and a 1 in an actual karaoke bar.
That's pretty good.
And then last question, who inspires you?
You know, this is a really interesting question. I feel so much of who I am today. I try to take a little bit out of almost everybody I meet. Every, you know, from my grandparents to my wife to my kids to my friends to my colleagues, I look at what they are best at. Everybody's really, really good at something, and somebody's really good at being kind to others, and other people are really good at leading very difficult discussions, and some people have a natural warmth to them. And, you know, I've been very, very fortunate that just my brain works in a way that I try to be inspired by everything that I look at and everybody I'm watching. And so I would say just generally people inspire me and they surprise me. And when they surprise me, I put away in my head what it is that their unique God-given ability is. And I try to emulate that, you know, in myself.
That's awesome. Well, Nitin, we appreciate you, and we appreciate, you know, all of the wisdom that you've dropped on this show. And of course, we love working with you. And again, thank you. Thank you for all the time you've given us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I look forward to actually seeing you in person when the pandemic ends. And thank you for the time and for having me on the show.
This episode of the Alchemy Podcast was brought to you by Philo. Thanks for tuning in. And if you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and share.